What does it mean to be free? We live in a world that is pulling from every direction, constantly poking at us with attention-stealing gimmicks of ever-increasing complexity. How do we navigate life in this world? How do we leave room for our friends and family? How do we make it all stop? Today's guest is Jeff Jimenez, a theology major from the University of St. Thomas. Jeff works in cybersecurity. He is a husband, father of four, and host of his own podcast, the Warrior Monk Podcast. Jeff is focused on uniting the clans of Catholic men to fight the culture of death. He knows firsthand the importance of true and genuine friendship and the obstacles that social media and our digital life can present towards this end. Join us for this two-part conversation as we talk with Jeff about how social media is designed to monetize our attention, manipulate our thoughts, and what we can do to fight against it. Welcome to the Beauty Ever New podcast.
Welcome, everybody. This is Rafael Morales.
Chris Duffel.
And we're here with Jeff Jimenez, who's joining us on the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for coming, man.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm a huge fan.
Awesome.
Our first and only huge fan.
I know. Yeah, you must be the one that actually rated our podcast. No.
5 stars?
Yeah. So, proud Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, sure. So for the last 12 years, I've been working in cybersecurity. And I went to University of St. Thomas, though, for theology. And the story is that I told the interviewer, if I can learn Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, I can learn C++, Python, SQL, and I got in. So language is language, syntax is syntax. And so for the last 12 years, I've been focusing on corporate cybersecurity, watching firewalls for bad guys, to now managing a team in security. And yeah, that's what I've been doing. And a lot of this touches on what we're about to talk about today.
Cool.
Awesome. So we're coming fresh off the episode on the poetic mode of knowledge. And a big part of the poetic mode is that there is a way of knowing that requires you to kind of be open to nature and open to what life has to offer. And it also is kind of born out of this idea that you need to be aware and fully alive to be able to receive what the world has to offer, right? And that is essential in trying to understand architecture, in trying to understand art, and ultimately in trying to understand God. So today we're going to be talking about social media and how that mediates our reality and makes it challenging to be open to the poetic mode and then ultimately to God. So why don't you just start us off telling us a little bit about, you know, just how social media works, how companies set it up, and what it is intended to do. But before we jump into that, we're going to have a full disclosure here. What are your social media accounts? Which ones do you have?
Yeah, what do you
All right, so the ones I've fought addiction with. Or
yes.
Okay, so I think I've deleted Facebook 5 times.
Okay.
But I'll count that as one.
Wait, does that mean you have logged back on 4 times?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
I've deleted it, and then learning that
did you close
it's
your
not
account?
Actually,
oh, okay.
Yeah, but this is before you could actually do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I deleted it back in 2008.
Yeah.
Shortly after I graduated college, I was 7. Twitter is a big one for professional reasons, and really that's it. Just those two. Okay. I would say, you know, I'd throw in YouTube.
Yeah. Yes.
What about I don't really log in though on YouTube.
Right. Yeah, but you use
media.
It.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So those would be the three big ones.
Mm. Chris?
Oh, man.
Full disclosure.
Full disclosure, everything. Yeah, yeah. I'm the kind of guy that will try lots of things. Now, I definitely have a password manager, so I have, like, you know, the auto-generated, like, 50-character, you know, whatever password. So they're all managed there. But anytime there's a new thing that comes out, I, like, try it when it's in, like, the really crappy beta mode.
Yeah.
And then end up just, like, throwing it out.
Yeah.
But
what do you use most?
Daily? Probably everything, like, you know, Google, like, knows me top to bottom. Because I use Google Docs all over the place. Gmail, Calendar, GChat, Chrome, so they have all my browser history. Safari for mobile devices, so that kind of pairs back and forth. YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Asana, Slack. The others kind of taper off, but that's probably the main. I'm sure Apple's keeping all my podcast statistics. And like, there's like embarrassing number of hours of podcasts that are listened to. So that's the main thing, though. It's like it's probably mostly right now things that I listen to. So it's a lot of podcasts and YouTube and Facebook. But like Facebook off and on. Like I feel I like Facebook when it is present but very infrequent. Like the more I like it, the less I use Facebook, the less I want to use Facebook. And like during Lent, I downgraded my Facebook use to once a week for like 20 minutes. And it was great because I liked it every time I got on. It was enough to see my family, see my friends, and I got off. But the times where I would break that fast and go longer, precipitously lost the advantages of Facebook for me. So that, I think for me, that's like the best use of it. So
for me, so I got off pretty much all social media. So I'm not on Facebook, not on Twitter, but definitely YouTube, man. They got me completely and they know me really well.
All that Joe Rogan.
I have Gmail. I have all that stuff. So Google knows me very well. But yes, but I did get off Facebook. Finally flipped the switch, deleted my account. I'm sure there's lots of people who wondered if I died or something.
Yeah, but you'll get that.
But honestly, like I feel weird not having it. Like I feel like a little bit of a stigma. Like I'm a strange person for not having it. You know,
the
like,
scarlet letter, the blue F. It's not.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
It creates tension with all your friends because we're on there. Why aren't you? What's wrong with us? Yeah, you say something wrong with me?
Yeah, it's a little strange. Yeah. It's like being from a small town.
You watch Game of Thrones? I don't watch Game of Thrones. What are you saying?
Exactly. Yeah. You know? But all right. So now, walk us through why these apps, why social media is so much fun, is so addictive, and what do we not know about what these companies are doing?
Before you say that, we have social media stuff. Check us out. Be Every New Podcast. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
It's not going anywhere.
Continue. Yeah. Yes.
All right. So jump in.
So I'll tell you what I used to think social media was. I used to think it was a way to connect with folks that I wanted to stay in contact with. I thought I would stay in contact with them. I thought it was a way for me to find information pretty quickly, catered to what I would want to see. I thought it was a way for me to learn new things that I wouldn't have found before because I'm seeing what my friends are doing, and I'm seeing what my friends are posting, learning how to be a dad from other dads, or learning what NFP was back in the day. So it was a big repository of knowledge for me. And then I started to realize I would ask the question very often, how did I get here? So I would start with a good intention, and then I started finding myself looking in other areas. Now I'm just in this kind of unending vertical scroll of information. And I started looking at myself and thinking, how much time am I spending on this thing? I'd get an alert and I'd feel like there was some sort of natural disaster happening, and I had to pick up my phone and look at it. There was a point in my career where I started getting these phantom buzzes in my leg from having a BlackBerry. I'm pretty old. But for those of you who don't know what that is, that was one of the early smartphones.
Dude, I've thought about getting my kids pagers. I'm like, you're not going to have a phone until you're like out of the house. Until that time, I'll get you a pager. You can borrow someone else's phone and call me. Seriously. Yeah.
There's a good priest who said, if you give your kid a cell phone before the age of 18,
the occasion of sin is so deep.
They will likely see porn in the first 72 hours is what this priest says.
I believe it.
So what we need to know about social media is that the original argument that we would hear from friends who say, you need to get out of Facebook, they'll say, well, I have nothing to hide. I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm not doing anything illegal or doing anything dumb. It's just my family that I'm posting. But what we're not seeing is that social media is interacting back with you. And so we don't know that innately, but we experience it. And so some of the jarring statistics for the youth are rising rates of depression, anxiety, Adam Silver with the NBA said that he gets a lot of millennial basketball players coming to him, telling him about how much anxiety they have in this new, they think it's the NBA, but he's like, no, we have a societal problem.
Yeah.
And so we just need to understand that social media presents a new kind of reality for us that's not real. And we need to find ways to mitigate that somehow, because it's going to interfere with how we come to know Christ and how we come to build relationships, how we evangelize, how we raise our children. And that's the problem I'm trying to tackle.
Yeah. What are some of the strategies that these companies use, or how do they design the software to make you addicted and to make you stay on their platforms?
First thing I would say is that there's two parts to social media. There's an addictive part, and then there's this other nefarious, even more nefarious part, the manipulative part. And what these social media companies claim to say, they claim that they're just doing the addicting. Now they're kind of owning up to it. You have former Google design ethicist Tristan Harris. So this guy worked at Google. He started seeing the tactics that they were using change society. So what are these tactics? One is fear of missing out, or FOMO. And this is exactly in my sphere in cybersecurity how we get people to give up their passwords, or how to give up that one password that unlocks their LastPass account that has the repository of all their other passwords.
Yeah.
And so what we do in cybersecurity is we train our folks not to react to anything that's urgent. Well, if you look at your apps on your phone, you'll see a red, in fact, I see one right now, there's a red little button on the top right-hand corner. And in all of human civilization, that red color means stop.
Fight or flight, yeah.
Yeah.
Someone's going to kill you. You better watch out.
Yeah. Better watch out, yeah. So Tristan Harris actually put out a slide deck that talks about that. He says what you feel when you see a notification is there's gonna be a nuclear explosion, but what's actually happening is someone liked your Facebook post.
Yeah.
So, and this is where the monetization of time and
attention, right?
Exactly.
Sure.
And your attention is now being monetized. Yeah. There's a whole business model around that. So that's just one, fear of missing out.
Yeah.
The other is called a variable schedule reward. What that means is, I'll give you an example. If you log on to Twitter, I have a Twitter account, the notification has a delay before that red button shows up. So I'm like that Pavlov puppy waiting for my reward of notifications. Either someone liked something I posted, or someone is trying to share my stuff. I get rewards from that. Or someone followed me. So it's friend follows, shares, likes, all of that stuff is a reward. So I wait for that. And so that's something innate in our human nature as well. This is why social media, I feel like, is so quote unquote viral, to use the negative term, really. But those two aspects right there are huge. And it's caused a lot of anxiety in our youth because they really don't know how to deal with this. We just kind of throw them out there.
Yeah.
And I'll give you another story. Chamath Palihapitiya, he's the owner of the Golden State Warriors. So he bought them from Facebook. He was a Facebook executive. And just last year, he spoke at Stanford to all the MBA graduates. And one of the questions posited to him was, you've recently said that this whole failing fast motto is not the best thing for anything that matters. And he went on to explain that that works in commercial media, but not for anything that matters, obviously. But it's because of social media that we have short attention spans, and we're trying. He said that social media is starting to program people to want to be. I guess they want information more compressed, right? So there's this information that's coming in has to be compressed, otherwise it lacks credibility to the new mind, and it lacks, I guess, oomph.
Yes.
So if you get long-winded, people are going to start not paying attention. And if you're listening to someone or watching someone on Twitter or Facebook and they don't have a lot of friends, the bias starts to come in that maybe they're not as credible. So there's a lot of effects that, unintended effects as well, that Chamath has been trying to point out.
It's similar to I saw this thing on Facebook yesterday about the contemporary cinemagraphic trends. More or less, you just cut every 2 or 3 seconds. And there was a scene in Star Wars where Darth Vader's fighting Luke, and they said, here's what it would look like if we had shot Star Wars today instead of whenever it was, back in the 70s, and totally recut, totally changed, like, you know, the capacity for watching something like 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh, man.
Makes today, it's like this crazy, you know, like 7 minute long scene where people are like, what's going on? This is like crazy. It's like,
yeah,
some like experimental type thing. But it's just like the way people viewed both like social media and film, they're sort of a singular thing in a way. And the rate of cuts being diminished is like what you're talking about, the size of acceptable like packets of information.
Right.
The smaller it gets, the more credibility it has.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with movies.
It's the same thing. Yeah. It's the same thing with the YouTuber, right? Mm-hmm. You have to create jump cuts. I looked into this because I was like, hey, maybe that'll be fun. Cause I used to do a lot of videos as a younger man. And I found that now it's just manipulating attention. That's all these videos. That's what clickbait comes from.
Shuck and awe.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah. It's just ever increasing. Mm. You know, because if it's all stimuli, right? And obviously, you eventually get used to a certain level of stimuli. Mm. So then you got to ramp it up. Mm. And so then if Twitter wants to keep up, they got to ramp it up. And then if Facebook wants to get ahead, they got to ramp it up. And so it's a constant almost arms race to try to stimulate people more and more and therefore end up manipulating them.
Yeah.
So as a faithful Catholic, do you think that we need to figure out what the, like, say you're a son of the church and you believe in who the church proclaims she is, do you try to find the contemporary jump cut, or do you say, like, there's no such thing as too much incense, let's like double down on things that like worked before?
I think this is where the logos comes in, right? That there is a right order to things. One of my favorite books is by Father James Schall, and that's the name of his book, The Order of Things. And he talks a lot about the order of our soul, and that we should be directing our souls towards salvation. And what we're finding with social media is that if something is pulling our attention away from something that a project like salvation is a lifelong project, now we're affirming ourselves spiritually with thumbs and, you know, likes and specific emojis that are acceptable, you know, so hearts maybe.
Yeah,
that's how I know him. You know,
that's how I'm known.
Yeah, that's how I'm affirmed.
Yeah,
correct.
That's a big challenge today, is our method of communicating how we measure our progress and how we affirm others has completely changed. I refer back to Chamath Palihapitiya, because we're talking about the guy who sold us Facebook, right? And he said in Stanford, I don't touch this stuff, in so many words.
Yeah.
My kids don't touch this stuff, in so many words. And it's caused a lot of tension with his friends. But at the very last moment, he pointed to the crowd, almost kind of like a gangster. Like, nobody controls me. Nobody programs me. But this is the guy who sold us. So it's kind of like the drug dealer who says, yeah, I sold crystal meth to those kids or those people, but I don't do that stuff.
Yeah, I would never do that stuff.
No.
Why would you?
And he even admits, right? So this is someone who ran the thing. He admitted that there were unintended consequences, but then he double speaks and says, I feel tremendous guilt. And in the back of our minds, we knew. I think this is the revenge of his conscience, frankly. And so he started a company called Social Good out of it to try to kind of change it while also keeping his wealth that he's earned from making us addicted and selling us ads. And you know, one of the big things about social media that people need to understand is that these free tools come at a cost.
Correct. Yes, because I think one of the big questions surrounding not only social media, but services like Gmail, services like Google Maps, which are constantly tracking you, constantly reading your conversations, it's obvious that they provide value. Otherwise, people wouldn't use them. The problem is the cost is really high. Like, if the cost is forfeiting your freedom, is it worth whatever value it brings? You know, and I think that's the big question. Facebook provides a lot of value. It does. Mm-hmm. But what are you forfeiting in the process?
And can we muster up the appropriate emotional response to act? Because I've heard people talk about how manipulative Facebook and Google are, and, you know, all of the laundry list of social media companies. And at the end of the interview, I believed it. And I was like, okay, what can I do?
Yeah, I'm doing it, yeah.
And the guy was talking about, like, Proton Mail. They have their servers in Switzerland, so they're outside of the EU jurisdiction, and they have all of this great stuff going on. So I was, like, signing up for a Proton Mail account. I'm, like, going into this thing. And then as the podcast goes on, they talk about how and I need to find which one it is. It's hard. I listen to so many different platforms.
It
was the Sam Harris one.
Yeah, it's the one we listened to.
At the end, he just says, but, you know, like, my wife's on Gmail, and like all my family and friends are too. So every email I send is going to be in the ecosystem. I can't get out of that. So even though I can remove the emails that I personally send out, if it's going to go right back into the system, you only need like 4 data points to identify an individual. You know this better than I do. I'm just citing stats from a podcast. Like, it actually means something to me.
I just Google it.
One day people will cite stats from our podcast. Something. But then, like, at the end, he basically said, you know, it's crazy. You should be really scared of it, but, like, you can't do anything about it. Just, like, throw your hands up. I'm like, God, man, I'm, like, ready to make the decision, ready to, like, let the axe fall. And he says, you know, you just can't, you would have to exercise so much of your digital life that it would be, it's an all or nothing thing.
Right.
They've gotten so good at targeting you. Like, when I find ads, it's always an ad that I actually want to buy the thing for, and I forget to go back to the website. I'm like, oh yeah, that's not annoying. I want that.
Yeah.
And that's the sale price. Purchase. And I hit the button and I buy it. Part of me recognizes that's in some way like offering up exactly what you want and reducing all the friction to buying something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, most of the time it's what I want to buy. So, you know, I'm not saying that I love that it's there, but in order to actually respond appropriately to the criticisms of the platform and the way they're, you know, digging into your brain and into your pocket,
right?
You kind of have to, like, it's not just the Benedict option. It's like, I'm going to go to, like, Mars. I'm not going to go to, like, you know, some place that's outside of culture as such.
I think it's akin to fighting lust, right? Hmm. The saints say, with lust, you don't fight it. You run from it. And because social media is exploiting human vulnerabilities, this is innate in our nature.
And
it's
at the deepest level
of our nature. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's exploiting our nature. Our eyes respond to red.
Mm-hmm.
The urgency and fear of missing out. And now even there's things like list bias. So this is kind of a little bit outside social media, but Google, mm-hmm. right? If you see something, if you search for something and you get a list, a numbered list, you're going to assume that the number one thing is the top search result.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't define what top search result is.
Yeah, yeah.
Usually it's either A, a paid ad, but mm-hmm. forget that.
Yeah.
If you actually look at the SEO results of your top search ad, or its top searched item, you're probably going to find that that really wasn't the most popular thing. Mm-hmm. But that's what we're assuming about these tools. And that's the same thing that happens with tools like Facebook, Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that what we're seeing is the most popular thing. And that's right. Where popularity starts to equal truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's a big fallacy in social media that's happening philosophically. So whoever's loudest is rightest.
Mm-hmm.
And
that feeds right into relativism. It feeds right into the idea that what makes something true is if enough people agree that it's true. I mean, it essentially reinforces that, and it almost proves it to be true because it's hard to argue with data, right?
Mm.
It's like, here's the data. Yeah. This is what people agree is what you need to be doing.
But there's a nuanced point there, though, that I heard a term recently called, I believe it's super credibility. It's probably another Sam Harris thing, where basically he says that at a certain point when the list of people that you trust acknowledge that a certain fact is true or a certain viewpoint or something is true, you just sort of take it as, like, this is what it should be. Like, if Amazon and Google and Facebook and, like, Tesla are all going to, like, send something to Mars, you're like, okay, it's probably not impossible. People aren't dumb. They figured it out. And there's something about, like, the market scenario that makes it feasible. And it's the same thing happens with, like, news stories where you just say, if these trusted institutions all agree, then surely there's not collusion across the board, like totally laterally. All these institutions don't align politically. So when I hear something like that, that's how, if I want to gut check something, I hear a story, I'll go look at, like, you know, the super traditional news service, the crazy left-leaning service, the, like, you know, the Wall Street Journal, like, ostensibly center. And you can kind of average them out and figure it out. And to me, like, the super credibility term is, it's different from the, you know, the majority of my Facebook friends believe it, therefore
it's
true.
Yeah, but I think going back to Jeff's point, if I use Google to search for these sources, for example, if I go in and I search for some event, mm-hmm. let's talk about the Notre Dame fire that just happened, you know, I wanted to search, you know, information about that. Well, Google will give me certain sites.
Yeah.
And unless I personally know what the conservative version of this stuff is, they may not show me that.
Mm-hmm.
They may not show me a balanced view of the story. They're just going to show me whatever they want to push, so to speak.
Sure.
So I guess when the tool itself is your method for attaining truth, mm-hmm. unless you somehow know of sources outside of this method of getting truth, all you're going to get is whatever Google tells you is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difficulty. Now, of course, part of the responsibility of truth seekers is to know the variety of sources where you can gut check things. But for the average person, I mean, for example, if you ask me to name, you know, the top five conservative journals in the United States, I would actually have a hard time telling you. I mean, I can probably name a couple. So now extrapolate that out, you know, and I tend to think I like to read, you know, so I like to look for this stuff. Extrapolate that out to my brother or to someone else who isn't that big into academics and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they probably have no idea what the other side is or what they would be saying. You know, like all they know is this is what I saw on Facebook. This is what I saw in Google.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hard part is how do you know what the other side is?
Yeah.
Another example of that is what happened recently with the Easter bombings in Sri Lanka.
But the Easter worshipers?
By former President Obama. Easter worshipers, right? On Twitter. Yeah. So it's amazing. Sri Lanka had to block Facebook across the whole country.
Really?
Because there was fake news about that was causing more violence. So they would react to fake news. There would be the danger of more violence. And then they found out that Sri Lanka was acting on fake news themselves, like thinking that we're going to be wrong, but they weren't.
Like the nation.
They just could not figure out what the truth was.
Wow.
So they just shut it down. They
had
to shut down Facebook completely.
Hmm.
So that example just shows right there that it's hard to decipher truth. There's companies out there like MediaWise that tries to show you how to find it. But a lot of times it's, you're like you said, Chris, you're cross-checking, you're referencing if this is being announced by the left, the right, the center. And then you're trying to find credibility through Google searches as well. So the tool that you would try to verify with is the same tool.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are a lot of biases that we have to fight. But then also, I mean, are we really spending our time wisely? This is about time and attention. And so what we're trying to talk about now is in a lot of my circles of friends is how, especially we just did an ascetical practice together, avoiding media for a while. And so we're trying to find how have we been using our time, and are we gaining our salvation through it?
Right.
Are we cooperating with Christ? I asked all of my buddies, like, who reads the Bible daily? Sad result.
Sure.
It was pretty bad, including myself. And so there's a lot of things that we could be doing, and I think that's the sin of our age, that Acadia.
Yeah.
That noonday devil that allows us to not to do anything other than what we should be doing right now.
Right.
And the saints were very single-minded. They were always focused on what they're supposed to do. And I think there is a story that Archbishop Fulton Sheen talks about a monk who was asked the question, if you knew that Christ was coming in the next 15 minutes, what would you do?
He's like, the same thing I always do.
I'd right
go
here.
Play cards. I'd do whatever. I'd like, you know, I'd eat my dinner. I'd go pray evening prayer. And then I'd like see him when I die or something.
Yes. I would be doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's really the key to happiness in this life, true joy. I think we'd have a lot more friendships if we were doing that, because we'd find ourselves spending more real time with
people. Yeah.
I've started calling friends more, right? So anyone that I know, I don't text very much.
Yeah.
And it annoys the crap out of my friends. Like, I just, I kind of get a kick out of it. I'm like, you're so drawn to this stuff. You're addicted. Yeah. Like, I was there. I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
They won't pick up the phone. Even my own brother, like, why'd you call me? Just text me. So this creates lots of barriers to creating meaningful friendships and relationships. Mm-hmm. I think social media has affected perceived notions of friendships. You know, there's three types of friendships that some researchers have found in social media. One, the last one is commemorative. It's your friends that are just about your past, and your friends, and when you see them, it's like a tombstone. Like a commemoration of what once was.
Yeah, of what you once had.
And really, your friendship is just on life support. That's what that means in your friends. So if you've got like 500 people, odds are about 450 of them are commemorative.
Yeah.
And a lot of people come and go in your life. But the problem is that in something like Facebook and Twitter, you're going to keep these relationships on life support. Mm. And it creates a kind of awkwardness, I don't know.
Right.
And then it gives you a false sense of security that, you know, people care about me. So there's a lot of confusion there. And, you know, the stats are showing tremendous amounts of, like, I say it a lot. So we're just not a happy people.
I have friends that I have no pretense of actually spending time with, but I like my Facebook feed because, like, after Trump's election, it was the most schizophrenic thing ever, because a lot of my, like, let's say conservative A&M friends were, like, fist pumping, like, smiling, and a lot of my Rice friends were, like, fist pumping but, like, shaking their fist at God and crying. And, like, I have a lot of my Facebook friends that I haven't purged, partly because it's just really interesting seeing across the arc of my life. Like, I started my freshman year, Facebook left Harvard. So it landed at A&M as I was getting there. So for me, college was synonymous with Facebook. It was like day one. It started, and everyone, like, you'd start, instead of exchanging texts, you know, numbers, stuff like that, you would, you know, share, like, friend profiles or whatever you did. Like me on Facebook, follow me on Facebook. And the growth of that was the growth of college for me. So it's I don't separate the two as a as two different moments in life, but I never really did do the purge, and I kind of like it personally, because I get to see it's like all of life compressed into a single feed, like friends who I haven't seen in probably like 15 or 20 years, like high school friends that somehow I started, you know, becoming friends with after we ever saw each other. But it's I realized after Trump's election why I enjoy keeping all the people around, and partly why I like Facebook too is I try to make it, for me, the main feed. You don't use Facebook at all, right? You said
no. I get drawn back in whenever someone has, like, some sort of tragic event
issue
page, you know. Yeah. It's like something, like, so we just recently supported someone whose daughter had cancer.
Yeah,
we supported someone who lost their baby to SIDS, which was terrible. That's the platform. Like I said, it's not going anywhere.
But yeah.
I end up coming back in, getting drawn back in reluctantly. But that's where I started to question myself. Am I really supporting them by getting on Facebook? Yeah. Or do I need to go over there and bring them a meal? Or I think that's also part of it. Or do I need to call them? Yeah. A lot of times we're afraid to call people too, especially in times of need. Or we're awkward with someone being vulnerable. I think that's that's something I've experienced. Like, I'll be vulnerable to, like, a buddy of mine, and like, man, shoot, I don't know what to do about that. And, like, it's all good, man. You're being a brother to me right now. So, but I do find that if I change my profile picture with the silhouette of France or something like that, that's not really doing anything. And I think that's where we start measuring the data in a different way. Is what am I actually doing good in my work and faith for my salvation? If I look on my phone, I can actually see on my iPhone stats of how long I've had screen time.
That was
a big wake up call.
It's sobering.
Several hours, really? Like, I didn't even know where that went. I thought of how many push-ups I could do. How many hours?
Yeah.
I thought about the time. No, seriously, I thought about the time with my kids. I thought about the people I could have talked to. I realized I have time for long conversations.
All that kind of stuff. If you know your reading rate,
every day
you can look at the number of words you read a minute and then transcribe that to like the hours you spend on Facebook and say, this whole shelf that I've been saying I want to read for years
is right there.
I could have been done with it.
Yeah.
In like a year if I would just put the phone down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's that creates a dilemma too, because sometimes we use social media to find things to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But I find myself wanting to find out what's going on with the Pope and Vigano's letter comes out or something else comes out. And I get caught up in all these current events. And I recently realized I haven't done anything for the benefit of the church just by knowing this even.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just as effective, if not least effective and more culpable than the person who doesn't know about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then a second Vigano letter comes out and then you get distracted. And then a third Vigano letter comes out.
And then and then like a fifth one comes out. And by then you're like, my gosh, this needs to turn into a drama series.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Netflix original.
Yeah. The Netflix original Vigano letters.
Vigano.
But I do find myself wanting to, I started to find myself more lonely the more I used it. Even after a long hiatus.
Yeah.
8 years, I think I was off of it.
Until really? Like 8 years?
I was. Wow. I deleted it, and I was gone. It was gone. And then I came back off and on the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Trying to get rid of it. And so I'm finding myself, and when I say addicted, I'm not on there for longer than 15 minutes.
Right.
But it's every day.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. Until recently, I would say the last 90 days. So trying to break this habit, this neurological vulnerability that's been exposed, I just know it'll come back if I don't create a hard line, a hard space.
Yeah.
We need to make a hard decision about this. And I'm finding that it's harder to grow in faith with something that's always drawing your attention.
Yeah.
Especially with Cardinal Sarah coming out with his book, Power of Silence.
Power of Silence, yeah.
You guys read that?
I've read excerpts.
The Power of Silence is on Formed. So anyone who has every parish in the United States has access to Formed. Formed is an app you can download on your smartphone.
Yeah.
Dodge all of the social media apps and go to Formed. It's on Facebook. Okay. But so you can access the document anywhere you want. Or you can buy the book and just like old school read it on paper.
Yeah. You should, if I converted all my Kindle stuff into actual paper, I'd probably fill up a couple rooms.
Yeah.
I already have a couple rooms filled, but I would need a couple more. And yeah, with Cardinal Sarah coming out with that book, that was a really powerful moment that I thought resonated with my soul, and that there was just so much noise, and that this noise really just comes from the devil. That there is a demonic activity whenever we're being distracted from our vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it pains me to think that my parents are posting pictures of my kids, and then my kids are going to want to see those pictures when they get older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because when I was coming up, I would go to my parents' bedroom and go look at the photo albums.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
where I would actually go back and look at the past.
Yes.
Versus having to log in and then have something interact back with me.
Yeah.
And so there was something more pure about that.
That's so true. That's my favorite part about Facebook, hands down. Like, I had a picture of my kid, my oldest son, 4 years ago. We were at the Houston Zoo, and there's this train that runs on the outside, and he was probably like 18 months old. And he see the train comes up, and he loved Thomas the Train. He could like name a bunch of trains. The train comes up, and he's like, his face lights up. And of course, I have my smartphone. I'm not like holding him. I'm like taking a picture of him with my phone. And I get the thing, and like it's on Instagram and Facebook. And Facebook reintroduces me to this moment.
Yeah.
And I love that thing so much. Like, that's like, if Facebook only were a like, here's a picture you took in the past and gave it back to you, which like I was telling Rafa this, and he was like, Apple Photos can do that for you. And you can just get off Facebook. That thing alone is something that it's
powerful.
Forward to. Yeah. It's super powerful.
But it's not the only tool that can do it too. So
no, it's not. But like, but that it does that.
But that it does that.
I'm like,
no,
maybe I'll see a cool pic today. I wonder what I did 4 years ago with my son.
Yeah.
Cause I love my kids.
I miss that too. I mean, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
The throwback pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are, I don't have a lot of those. Like, remember what you did back in college? I'm like, man, I don't remember.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
No, and actually, I don't want to.
Yeah.
But thanks for the reminder that I don't want to be here. But there's also another thing that I see, especially with, I've got a younger brother. He's 6 years younger than I am. I see with his friends, and it's hard to talk to his friends because of the attention span.
Really?
But it's also, there's a social acceptance that comes with not, you know, like the stigma. If you're not on there, we talked about that earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're not on there, like that's an even added pressure that you're not normal, that you're not,
that you're not part of the social. Yeah, that you're not part of the community.
Yeah, and that's where we challenge this notion, like what's a real community, what's real friendship, what's real relationships.
Yeah.
If all you're talking about is your lunch or your new keto diet recipe, I mean, we're not really benefiting in our salvation that way. And I think that's in the time that we're in right now, where if you try to be orthodox, you're questioning yourself now. Like, am I really orthodox?
So talk for a moment about genuine friendship. Like it seems like that's really important. And like, if I had to stick a flag in the conversation here, I would say that the future of the church lives and dies based on like lots of other things that you could argue are more important. But if community is not a thing the church does well, if you don't love others, then like people leave, right? I have friends who have, anecdotally, I have a, let's say a friend who is, you know, married to someone who is baptized Catholic, doesn't practice, discover the faith through the scriptures at a non-Catholic church, loves it. And she's trying to find a way to like get her husband into a Catholic Bible study. And there are no Catholic Bible studies that she goes to where she feels welcome or he feels welcome. Super big indictment of the church, right?
Sure.
And massive indictment of the church. She's like, he wants to read the scriptures. He wants to talk about the faith. He hasn't done it in a long time. And she feels like there's no place to go. So that's like one concrete example of how if there's no community, people just won't show up. So all this we're talking about in some way undermines what you talk about as like an inauthenticity to friendship. So talk about that for a moment. Like what is it to you? What is genuine friendship?
Yeah. So friendship in the Catholic sense really derives from our relationship with God and how it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
So our friendship with our Lord is to allow us to love him and know him and essentially behold his face in the beatific vision. And so to get to that point, our Lord sends us other folks in time, just like St. Francis had St. Clair.
Mm-hmm.
The saints had each other.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus had Martha, Mary, and Lazarus.
Mm-hmm.
He wept for Lazarus.
Mm-hmm.
He had, and he saved his soul, right, and his body.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're learning from that example in scripture is that we're ordered toward Christ. That's where our life comes from.
Mm-hmm.
That's our purpose. That's our end. That's our final end, our eschatological end, our final cause, in all those terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we have friendships that maybe are inauthentic or short term and we can't talk about these things, we can't be vulnerable. We can't talk about what's going on in our lives. What are the obstructions?
Mm-hmm.
This is really kind of a model of a real fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
When we can't do that, we find ourselves, we might lose our salvation.
Yeah.
It's very, very likely we'll lose our salvation, especially as men, which, we learn shoulder to shoulder accomplishing a mission. We don't really learn from intuition. That's the, as John Paul calls, the feminine genius. We don't have that genius. And so we have to learn through friendships. And it's sad too, you know, that as I look at genuine friendship, it's hard to find, it's hard to build. But when you have even less time to build it, and that's what your salvation depends on, that's a huge missing gap. You know, when Augustine talks about our hearts being restless, which is what this podcast is named after.
Beauty ever new.
I think about all the saints and how they had friends, community.
Mm-hmm.
They really all exemplified how to be a friend. And it was always admonishing each other to be better, to live a reparative lifestyle, of daily mass, adoration, to push each other to do that. And so that's what I want out of a friend.
Yeah.
To push me towards my ultimate end.
Mm-hmm.
Have some fun on the way. And then even more than just myself, to help me push my children along that way as well.
Yeah, dude, totally.
You know, that's the biggest fear I have is this is with now augmented reality coming out. My kids found my phone and they almost cracked my password. Like, what? What's going on? I'm like, yeah, Dad, I saw what your thumb was requesting on. I'm like, no, we're not doing that.
Cybersecurity Dad, and he was like, yes, my kids got it.
I was secretly proud. You know, it's one of those like, don't ever do that again.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You're awesome. Yeah. So they learn. Yeah, they definitely learn from my desires of cybersecurity and self-defense and jiu-jitsu and all that kind of fun stuff.
Oh, nice.
But I do enjoy knowing this information I have now and now executing on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so on a daily basis, I try to call a friend, mm-hmm. even folks that are, you know, distant. Mm. I'll call Rafa like twice. Yeah. He won't pick up because he's busy with his kids. But we should return to that. You know, the nice thing about the phone, why I think the phone should overtake social media, is that the phone usually doesn't watch you and send you ads, right? You're not. Usually, I get phone calls. Yeah. If I get a phone call from an ad on my
it's
work,
like a robot
line,
call.
Yeah, it's a robot call.
And you can tell pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Or someone from China calls. I'm like,
do you answer the phone if there's not a if it's not saving your phone?
No. Usually I don't, and I get a lot of voicemails that way. So we used to have a way with the phone. When the phone would ring in the landline, we just would ignore it, pick it up, and hang it up. We could control the incoming feedback. Like, there was no feedback actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that would actually make people even more happy. Mm-hmm. How many people are on Facebook wish that person would actually call them?
Right.
I know for sure. I've surveyed some of my buddies. They're like, they actually want that human interaction over and above. And this is just kind of distracting us until that actually happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how hard true friendship is. It's incredibly difficult. You know, like, you obviously can have friends where it is very simple and very easy. And it's like, but true friendship is very difficult. And I think part of the challenge is social media can lead you to believe that all the people that you interact with on there are your friends and that they are true friendships. Now, some of them may very well be because you interact with them daily. But just speaking from my experience of social media, it always felt like, you know, as long as a lot of times it would be around sporting events or the World Cup, and you would feel like you interacted with a couple of people from high school and all of a sudden you feel like you reconnected. It never left me with the desire to then keep going and give them a call or keep going and go visit them. It was I touched their lives. I kind of had a point of contact, and that's good enough. Mm. You know, like, it left me with a satisfaction because I connected with them, right? When in reality, it was the illusion of a connection. It wasn't a true connection, not in the way that you do when you have a great conversation with someone. And what I've learned is that I have begun to place more value in personal conversation than anything else. So, for example, I would rather go, you know, with Chris, it's not a problem because I see him all the time, so we just talk all the time. But I would rather go weeks without talking to someone, but then physically get together and just catch up. It's like, you know what? It's okay. Like, we haven't talked. We didn't message. We didn't, you know, constantly be in contact. But we're going to get together for a couple hours and reconnect. Mm-hmm. And to me, the power of that as compared to, let's say, the pinging on Facebook, there's just no comparison. You know, there's no comparison. So even if you maybe don't see a friend all that often, but if you connect with them for an hour or two, I mean, that's going to be 10 times more powerful than anything you'll ever experience on Facebook, you know?
Yeah, it's an illusion that just because we can reach out to someone digitally that we're actually making meaningful relationships. Just look at your relationship between you two buddies, right? You guys work together, right, on a daily basis, I would say, and you talk to each other outside of Facebook, outside of social media. Obviously, you don't have a social media account. But I would imagine that even if you did, that you probably wouldn't spend that much time even talking to each other on there when you know you could just say it to the person and say it to the other in person.
Yeah.
And I think we have this innate desire to be vulnerable, but we can't be vulnerable to 575 people on Facebook that are friends with us.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, it's only my friends.
Hmm.
I think it's hilarious whenever my friends say, well, I'm only posting on my friends. I'm like, 575 friends? Like, how much time do you have? Are you retired?
So practical. Let's get like just nuts and bolts for a moment. How many friends is like an acceptable number or a legitimate number? If you could throw a number at it.
In scriptures, it says you're lucky if you have one. That's how hard it is to have a real, genuine friendship. Someone who's going to be loyal to you to work for your salvation,
mm-hmm.
it's usually your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the friendships that we have to continue to foster.
Absolutely.
You know, this year, full disclosure on the show, this is going to be, the May 30th will be 10 years for us.
Hey, August 15th
for us. Oh, yeah, hey, nice.
10 and 10.
That's August 15th. That's August 15th. The assumption.
Yeah,
that's when we got engaged.
We get the privilege of attending Assumption Mass every year for our anniversary.
So. That's fantastic.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah. See, that's awesome.
10 years for me next year.
Next year?
10 for you.
Yes. Yeah. Bro.
Woo. Yes. We're giving high fives here at the table. If you can't see our hand motions on the podcast. If you can, that'd be really creepy.
And, no, but this was on Facebook Live, then we could.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so... I forgot the question.
How many friends?
How many friends?
Like, legit. I get your one friend thing, but like, if I have legit friends,
really,
like
really,
five,
yeah, three, it's going to be seven? Under five. I would say you probably have three that are concerned about your entire well-being.
You
got
to put time into it. I mean, you have to see.
It's a hard work. I mean, it really is.
Like phone calls and if I think about this,
one of those spots is taken up by your spouse already. So
no, but I mean seriously, think about this. So you have your spouse. If you have siblings, you're done.
That's right.
Yeah, if you keep up with them.
I mean, like, I share a fence with Rafa. Like, we literally have a fence between our houses. When our kids go hang out, they go to the hole in the fence, and they say, meet me at the square. And they, like, go, like, talk at the thing. That's, like, their Facebook, you know, which is really cute. But if you don't have friends, I mean, if you don't have siblings, then maybe you could have, like, room in your life for friends. But if you have kids, if you have a spouse, if you have siblings, you owe it. You have a duty to be a good brother or sister to them. And to be a good, you know, son or daughter to your mom and dad,
right?
And to your wife, and to the extended family, and you can have friends. I'm not saying you can't have friends, but I'm saying, like, by default, if you have a family of any, you know, size at all, you're already booked. And if you have a job, and if you have any hobbies, like, the time is just like zero.
Yeah.
So, pretending like you can have, you know, dozens or hundreds or thousands of friends even. And it's like you have acquaintances.
You're
fine casually seeing something about their life. But when I say friend, I'm talking about like someone who, like, you ought to know how they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by this is if they need you, you need to be there for them. So how many people are you present enough in their life to where if they like fall for some reason, like they get in like an abusive relationship, or they have someone that dies, or they have like they need you. How many people are you actually? And I never really have thought about this for myself. Probably not a lot. Probably like less than five people outside of my wife and my family. Very, very few who, if something substantial happened to them, not just like I would know generally, like, oh, they got a new job or they live in Dallas now instead of Houston.
Yeah.
Like I would be there for them, and I'd be willing to sacrifice some of my time or my money or my something. To be present to them. It's not a lot of people.
No, it's not. And community really starts. Friendship is the basis of community.
Yeah.
Right. And so if we're going to try to do anything related to the Benedict option,
right,
it's going to take a lot of time with a lot of people. You're going to have to invest time with people that you may not 100% agree with, but you're going to do it for the sake of something even greater than just the two of you in hopes that you're going to achieve that pearl of great price.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. The best way to enjoy the podcast is to pull up the accompanying blog post for the episode at beautyevernew.com. There you will find show notes, guest information, helpful visual aids, and more. To continue the conversation, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let us know how you're experiencing beauty in your churches and communities.